Welcome back to Tom Hanks Defence Force, the only Tom Hanks name podcast which has had a tweet liked by a member of the Time 100 list,
Brie Larson.
Thank you to everyone who has followed our page and checked us out because of that infamous tweet, which is I'm going to get framed on my wall now. But yeah, thank you for joining us on this journey, and we hope you enjoy the show.
And now for our feature presentation, Tom Hanks Defence Force. With your hosts, Alex Halpern and Jack Fryer. A podcast for people who love film, television, and Tom Hanks.
Welcome back to Tom Hanks Defence Force on this sunny, sunny day. It's amazing. It's
actually sunny.
I mean, it's global warming as well, but it's we don't care about that for now. Obviously an important cause, and every effort in public policy should be directed towards actually solving this crisis.
But for now, we're going to enjoy the first sun for 4 months.
Tom Hanks Defence Force live from a pub. Yeah, we're actually going to leave this podcast and go straight to Extinction Rebellion afterwards. Anyway, so today's episode, we're going to be freestyling. Yes, this is another freestyle episode. Jack and I have no particular set topics that we want to discuss, as we did with the Lord of the Rings episode.
We've got a starting point, and we're just going to go from there, see what happens for the next half hour.
We just make it up. Well, we don't make it up. We have things to say. We have research, but yeah. there's no set topics as such. But the one overarching theme is The Phantom Menace.
Celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. 20 years of The Phantom Menace.
So that's crazy to think about. I'm waiting for my white hair to start popping out.
It's been 20 years of Jar Jar, Sebulba, Darth Maul, pod racing, and the most infamous phase, that's Wizard Annie from Kitster. So, yeah.
Are you sure? I mean, I thought the most famous phase was the
Brian Blessed as Boss Nass there.
Boss Nass.
That's an absolute amazing character. I love Boss Nass.
I love how uncharacteristic he is of all the gun guns. Yeah. Because he's the gun guns. He's
just a big toad, isn't he, at the end of the day, isn't
he? Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, they have this much more sort of almost anthropomorphic, amphibious look to them, but they look more like ducks,
yeah,
like double platypuses.
Yeah,
he's just a ball of slime.
He walked off a set of Wind in the Willows as Toad and just got roped in to do this for his mate George
just
Lucas.
Yeah. find himself on the set of Lucasfilm.
Yeah,
do you know how much of a creative influence Kathleen Kennedy had?
I don't think she was involved with Lucasfilm at this point. She became the head when Bob Iger and George did that infamous handshake, which I got you on a coaster.
Oh, you did, yeah. Yeah. And then Kathleen Kennedy just like exploded out of that
coaster,
out of that that handshake.
Yeah,
the lights appeared above them. So obviously, Kathleen Kennedy just came down from the sky.
Yeah, so like 6.5 years ago, which is also scary to think about. Disney bought another company. They bought Lucasfilm, gave them the rights to Star Wars, Indiana Jones, all the other things under the Lucasfilm banner.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, then Kathleen Kennedy was new head of Lucasfilm because George Lucas wanted to retire with his with his $4 billion and with his poultry sum of $4 billion.
I mean, if you can retire, try to retire with $4 billion.
He did give $2 billion to educational charities, which was an amazing gesture, though, which was good. So,
oh, huge, yeah. Have you seen that Lego set of? I know you sent it to me, didn't you?
I think
George
so.
Lucas lying on top of $4 billion.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's. I guess, you know, if Disney had, I guess, if Disney were that involved with the Phantom Menace was when it was Maze, do you think it would have come out better?
Yeah, I think if it was Disney managing George Lucas, I think they could have reined him in a bit. I think they could have had a script editor to touch things up. They could have they could have brought in another writer, I feel.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, but I feel like they would have been a lot more conscious of how it tied into the wider Star Wars brand. I feel like, you know, because George Lucas was too concerned with making a film that was like quite political and solely about the rise of Anakin Skywalker as Darth Vader.
And he
Vader.
Was concerned with symmetry. He said it was the whole thing. It rhymes. Like there's so many scenes where which like a shot for near shot for shot are like identical to the main trilogy. So
oh really?
Yeah. There's like a whole video on YouTube about called Poetry. Like, it's like all shots, which different shots from like the prequels, which line up or are very, very similar with
the
like,
original trilogy.
Yeah,
I didn't know that, but I feel like, I mean, none of the characters were really like well-rounded enough. None of them felt like the Star Wars heroes from the original film, the original trilogy even. And I think since Disney bought it,
yeah,
they've, and I guess, you know, pulled in people like J.J. Abrams,
yeah,
there's been so much more of a focus on this roundedness.
Yeah.
On, you know, start, like, characters that are fleshed out and are more like fantasy characters, and they're a bit more, they're more likable, and they like, you know, they do things with purpose. It's like, not like everything revolves around Anakin, yeah, becoming Darth Vader.
Because one of the big things of Star Wars is like all minor characters are like massively fleshed out in like all the expanded universe, like novels, comics, games, all given like.
Which is why people love fantasy and, yeah, sci-fi, because there's a lore behind it.
Like, you know, there's like a whole book about, which is actually a good book which I read, which is a whole book about Phasma and how she became a part of the First Order and the captain. Like, obviously, in the film, she's only in it for like literally a few minutes, like 7 and 8. But like, there's, yeah, like a whole hardback novel of it, of about Phasma's
like,
origins.
You're a real person. Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, are these books written by the same people who write the wiki?
Wikipedia?
Yeah.
There's like New York Times best-selling authors like write them. So there's like, and prominent fantasy and sci-fi writers like write them, and then they will come back to them years later. Because there's like a character, like Timothy Zahn, who wrote the Thrawn novels, which was one of the major factors of Star Wars becoming relevant, because it was like what happened after Episode 6, when they decided to bring Thrawn back into canon when Disney took over, because obviously Disney discarded the whole expanded universe after 6 and renamed it Legends. They'd still take things from Legends and bring it into the canon. And Timothy Zahn came back when they decided to bring Thrawn back to help out with the character, because he's like so attached to his character, and he's a fan favourite, so yeah.
Yeah, they develop a relationship.
Yeah, so I think Phantom Menace, obviously, when did you first see, so Phantom Menace came out 1999, you know, the same time as years of Matrix, Fight Club, and many other 90s classics.
It's when the 90s died.
Yeah. Obviously, when did you first see The Phantom Menace? When did you first see it? Do you remember when you saw it?
I don't think I saw it in cinemas. I think I did see it on VHS.
Yes, yeah.
It would have been, yeah. Either at my grandma's house or maybe my mum bought it.
Okay.
But I think at that time I wasn't as, I didn't care about the characters and the story and about the actual, like, you know, the technical aspects of how a good story is written. I was blown away by particular scenes. Number one being when they're leaving the Gungan city.
Okay.
And then all the giant fish and sea monsters.
Oh, and yeah, the fish
start,
yeah,
chasing each other. Yeah, I thought that as a spectacle was incredible.
Do you know,
we didn't have that massive a TV.
But you have this great
sense of scale.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
And that was the first time that, you know, me being really exposed to Star Wars, because I hadn't seen the original. I think I actually saw that first.
Really?
I think The Phantom Menace was actually the first Star Wars film I saw.
Wow.
And that was from a time when I wasn't as engaged with film as I am now. I was a child.
Yeah.
I was a very different person back then.
You hadn't seen Citizen Kane at that time. You're like, with your glass of milk, like, Mother, can you please play Rio Bravo?
Just all of, like, all of these like cosmic realities stemming out of my brain.
No, yeah.
That scene, the final battle, the battle with the duel with Darth Maul. So all the particular, yeah, the action and,
yeah,
sci-fi sequences.
Okay.
And then I realised afterwards, because so much of the dialogue with Trade Federation and Jedi Councils, a lot of that dialogue, not all of it, but a significant amount, is actually pretty boring.
Yeah, that's what it is, yeah. Because when I first saw Phantom Menace, like, oh, before I mistake, interesting trivia, one of the delicacies that is served on... You've seen Solo, but you know Paul Bettany's barge he's on?
Yeah.
One of the delicacies is the second fish from Phantom Menace. It's Colo Clawfish. That's a thing I found out.
That's crazy. What's the giant hammerhead shark-like thing called?
I know the first one's like the big... I know the Colo...
The first one's the fish.
Then there's the massive one. But I know the Colo Clawfish is the second one. You know, the one where they power down and they turn the lights on. It's just there. That's the one they serve on the boat.
Okay,
yeah, I used to know the names when I was young, so I had like an encyclopedia of a Phantom Menace when I was younger.
Which looks almost reptilian.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Are there three or four?
There's three.
Like, yeah, because there's the fish, there's the...
With the tongue, then there's the big one, then there's the middle one, then the big one eats the middle one, and then Liam Neeson goes, there's always a bigger fish.
Which, yeah, and then Liam Neeson eats the bigger fish, and then he just... and then Boss Nash just swims out. just swallows it.
Yeah,
I think... I mean... Those
I'd hate to be in a lifeguard in Naboo. Like, oh, not again.
But that's the scene that I feel like a lot of people who watch The Phantom Menace just forgot about.
Yeah.
Like, it's when you think of The Phantom Menace, what do you think of?
Darth Maul. I just think Darth Maul, Jar Jar, the pod racing.
The interesting thing about it.
Darth Maul?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how would you have... I mean, including Darth Maul, if you want to or not, how would you have made The Phantom Menace differently? Say Disney hires Jack as the producer to remake The Phantom Menace.
Before I say that, I want to say when I first saw Phantom Menace, just for context, like when I first saw it, like I watched the original trilogy before because remember my dad bought like the re-release on VHS because it came out in the cinema in 97, but obviously I was too young to see it then, so he bought the VHS of all three, and I burned through all of them, and like, we watched all of them together, and it was great. And they actually showed me how to work with video players, so I used to wake up early in the morning and go to Thursday to watch it again. So that's how they showed me how to work the VHS, just so I could watch Star Wars again. Save you waking them up, yeah.
Wow, that's, I mean, kudos to you for your integrity.
Yeah. So, basically, I saw Phantom Menace in the cinema, and I saw it with a friend and his parents and just my dad. Mm. My friend cried when Qui-Gon died. And thing is that I did cry.
I hope everyone's seen this if they're listening to this episode.
Thing is that I did cry. That's because they turned the volume up at the end for the big end parade. So obviously, I used to have, as like a heavy metal fan, it's weird, but I used to have really sensitive hearing. Like, I had to wear earplugs in school assembly when I was really young. I used to have to wear earplugs in school assembly when I was sang the hymn because I used to have really sensitive hearing, but as I got older, it kind of just disappeared.
The power of God in your ears.
But I used to have to like wear earplugs because everything was so, but I didn't. And when they turned the volume up, I like cried, and I just
So you're wasting
everyone's like in the cinema. I saw like walking out, and my dad's consoling me, saying, "Jack, the loud noise has stopped.
It's okay."
But that's good because if I'd remake the Phantom Menace, like I would start it off in the same way, I think. But I think like, I know that the beginning gets a lot of flack, like people saying, like, why would they send Jedi and not tell the trade version Jedi? Jedi's effectively They're like trained like knights in a way, you know. They're trained soldiers, even though they don't go off and fight wars.
Yeah,
they effectively are trained in combat. Why would you not tell them that they're going to be negotiating? that's kind of stupid. Like if you start to pick holes in it, but I think I would have it as that. But I would have it that they're aware they're Jedi's, but thing is, though, I still have them like trying to fight their way off. But I think you'd have a lot more. I think I'd have combat droids as well to kind of test the Jedi a bit more.
Yeah.
And with blast support, so they're kind of overwhelmed and... I'd like to see a bit of a droidicus come and just throw the droidicus in the air like, whoop, like, oh no, they're gone through the ceiling.
Interesting. I think I'd open it with a scene with Darth Vader actually in it.
Vader?
With Vader, yeah.
Really?
So obviously, you know, a flash forward, but it shows Vader being incredibly cruel.
Yeah.
And I think that would work because, you know, it's not a long scene at all. Just Vader doing something evil. Because if we were remaking it now, we've already had the intro to Kylo Ren as being, you know, malicious and cruel.
Yeah.
You know, being the villain that he's supposed to be. Yeah. And given he idolizes Vader.
Yeah.
You know, given his complete, you know, desperation to become the new Vader, I feel like having an intro to The Phantom Menace which emphasizes what Kylo Ren aspires to become could be quite interesting. I'd have maybe a bit less mystery surrounding the Jedi at first. I mean, everyone knows who the Jedi are, but I might have it... It would then cut to a... Yeah, maybe a sequence about like the importance of the lightsaber and like why the lightsaber has, why the lightsaber has mattered to the Jedi for so long, and just sort of explore the lore a bit more.
Yeah,
because people like, sorry, one second, man. Because the Phantom Menace tried to explore the lore in a bit more detail. It just did it really boringly.
No, yeah, I kind of agree. Because
the fish scene.
Because there's actually a really good YouTube video about where this guy remakes a Phantom Menace and it actually works really well. Like, I've not seen it for a couple of years, but he remade the whole prequel trilogy. A lot of it's actually good. But he said that the prequel trilogy should have been Obi-Wan's story, not Anakin's. And I like the idea of Obi-Wan starting off as a Padawan. I think Qui-Gon dying at the end, I still would have had that.
But then would you have been happy with more mystery around, but almost complete mystery around Darth Vader?
Because I would have had Anakin as older. I agree with that video that Anakin should have been a teenager.
Yeah.
Because the video suggests that the pod racing, Qui-Gon should have had a hunch.
Yeah.
And not just him being, I'm the only human who can do it kind of thing. So yeah.
Yeah, that's true. We would have made it way less racist.
There's so many kind of stereotypes that if you look at it, the Nemoidians, people say that they are Japanese stereotype. People say obviously Jar Jar's a Rastafarian stereotype. Watto, people some say he's a Jewish stereotype.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of even if they're unintentional. Obviously, yeah. George Lucas isn't making this film to show his racist worldview, but. He's, yeah, I mean, we're more aware of that as a collective culture now. I think so many more elements of the film could have worked if it wasn't for the dialogue that let them down. These really, like, one-dimensional, cringy lines, they just sound funny when they're meant to be taken seriously.
One of my worst bits of dialogue, I think, is the ship captain, who's so much Captain Obvious. Like, the shields are gone, like, that droid there did it, you know? It just feels like... There's the blockade. Like, they're just flying straight towards a ship. He goes, there's the blockade. Like, no, what? You're flying towards a group of ships.
Yeah.
And then, like, a whole siren goes off to show after they've been hit. He goes, the generator's been hit. I'm like,
no.
I do like that little introduction to R2, because it shows how he's the luckiest droid there is.
Yeah, and C-3PO.
Yeah,
his introduction's good, as he is, and how he's still, like... I think they do a good job of showing that C-3PO is always a work in progress. Like, there are always problems with C-3PO.
There's a really good comic about Vader, but it's in episode 5, and he finds C-3PO's remains. There's just a bit where he just picks him up and just holds him to his head, and his Imperial officer's going, sir... Sir, he's just like, you can clearly see from this comic, he's just literally just reminiscing about the droid he once built when he was a child, so yeah.
Sad, it's actually quite emotional.
Yeah.
Do you think, would you have had Qui-Gon Jinn in there?
Yeah, because I think if you showed off Obi-Wan as already just a knight, because some people think it would have been good if you disregarded Qui-Gon and had like Yoda as Obi-Wan's mentor, because obviously Obi-Wan does say in the original trilogy, he was once my master, so yeah.
Yeah, it's
something like that. Yeah,
true. But I feel like I did kind of like how Obi-Wan was more youthful.
Yeah,
like, it wasn't nothing like the Luke Skywalker kind of youthful, but he was. Luke was more like, you know, the whole Luke trilogy is like an archetypical fantasy hero. He's swept up in this mission to
he's like the farm. He is literally just like a farm boy, like.
Yeah,
Sword in the Stone kind of in a way, isn't
he? He's the same character as Aragorn and Jon Snow and Harry Potter.
Yeah,
finds himself in an impossible situation.
Someone who thinks that, like, say with Harry, you know, someone who thinks ultimately turns out he's got great power.
Exactly,
and that he's capable.
It's a classic
fantasy
story. It's a story of Christ, essentially.
Yeah,
and we'll discuss in more detail in our upcoming religion episode.
Yeah, because obviously, because a lot of Star Wars is like based heavily on fantasy. Like, Obi-Wan's the wizard, Yoda's like the frog who turns into a wizard as well. Yoda is, yeah. Like, C-3PO and R2-D2.
I love how that's kind of a fantasy archetype.
I like, you know...
the frog that turns into a wizard.
Yeah, like, the people they think... Because it's like a fantasy trope. You think these things just harmless and turn out to be like a great power.
Yeah.
And C-3PO and R2-D2. They're like the Rosencrantz-Guildenstein, you know? Like, the two peasants, you know? Hidden Fortress, yeah.
Yeah, and the gravediggers in Hamlet.
Yeah.
I thought more Rosencrantz-Guildenstein.
Every double act, yeah.
They're just... I mean, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are just there. That's the problem. I think... I mean... I think if it was a remake nowadays, they'd have a... You know, they'd do a completely different story, given that... I mean...
Because obviously, the whole Palpatine arc is literally Hitler's rise to power, isn't it, as well?
Sure. But I don't think I don't think Disney would listen to, like, the loudest voice in the fan base that much. I mean, if you think about Kylo Ren being a stroppy teenager, he's literally a Star Wars fan.
Yeah.
he's one of these people that goes online and like, no, the Last Jedi should have ended this way because my opinion has a greater understanding of the lore and the...
Yeah.
Like, everyone's storylines.
Yeah.
It's stupid. So I think that's Disney saying, like, that's you.
Yeah.
Like, you're the problem.
You didn't get it your own way. Tough.
Well, content creators don't owe you anything. Because I think, Disney Disney is not butchering the Star Wars franchise. It's just taking it in a direction which, for some people, it does work. For some people, it doesn't. It's opinion-based.
I think the problem with The Last Jedi is that so many people had, like, these fan theories about Luke, Snoke, Kylo Ren, Rey, and all that that they held on to for, like, 2 years. And when The Last Jedi came round and completely change their expectations of what was going to happen.
Yeah.
It, like, they were just so angry and let down by it. I think that's what happened. Because Luke, like, a massive spoiler here for The Last Jedi, but Luke's death is one of the most Jedi things ever. He goes out, he stops a whole army without taking a single life. That's a complete Jedi thing to do. And he saves a bunch of lives in the process. Because Jedi is more, I think, about peace. And, like, even they say in the original film, the Jedi uses his power for defense, not attack.
Exactly. I think, yeah, and it does. And I think a lot of people, I mean, do you think people were more concerned with Luke dying or just the way he fended off the New Order?
The First Order.
Order, sorry.
I don't know.
The New Order.
Because the First Order, I liked the whole force projection thing. I think people were expecting this whole thing. Because in, like, the expanded universe, like, Luke used a force one of the novels to, or comics, to bring down an AT-AT walker.
Yeah.
And he was just super powerful. And, like, Grandmaster Luke, when he became, like, the Grandmaster, he was just such a... He was just ridiculously powerful. He was, like, insanely, yeah. He was just so... Apparently moving so fast, he literally just saw his green lightsaber and that was it. I think people were expecting him just to, like, bring down all the walkers with his, like, force powers or something. And I think people...
But
that's absolute power, though, I think.
Yeah, and is that a Jedi thing to do?
No.
I mean, he held them off through non-violent...
And cunning his own cunning.
Yeah, exactly.
He played Kylo's weakness against him.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't, you know, I guess it probably would have been permitted to, you know, to kill Kylo Ren and bring down all the, you know, the New Order 80-80s that were there. But it's, yeah, but we have to remember that Luke is a, you know, like, Luke is sort of almost completely one with the Force, so any chance he'll get to use non-violent resistance, he will.
Because people forget that in The Last Jedi, no, not The Last Jedi, Return of the Jedi, which is my favourite Star Wars film, he throws his lightsaber down in front of the Emperor as a complete act of defiance in the fact he refuses to give in to the dark side. You know, throwing down your lightsaber and just saying no in front of arguably the biggest evil of the galaxy...
Yeah.
It's just, instead of, is, and just saying, no, I won't do this. And that act of sheer, like, of sheer refusal to give in is what makes Darth Vader turn against the Emperor and throw him down the chute.
Well, exactly, because that was the Force that was taught to him.
Yeah.
But do you think that's emphasised in The Phantom Menace?
Well, honestly, like, I think Phantom Menace, because I spoke to a friend about Phantom Menace and he said he liked the idea of Jedi as just like Ronin, you know, like samurai just wandering around. He think the idea of Hangman was like a big council and like having a whole temple and like training facilities and they have different like ranks
so
and a library.
Sure, but then so much of the importance of the Jedi is that they are protectors of the peace.
Yeah,
you know, they know their responsibilities. Yeah. And they have the superhero ethos. With great power comes great responsibility. So they're not just wandering in the universe trying to become more one with the Force.
Because it was the Jedi's ways that brought them down to him. Because if they just let Anakin love and told him not to repress his feelings, but if they realise feelings are actually powerful, it's why Luke brought Vader back, because his love for his father was so strong it won him back over.
Yeah, I don't think Lucas did that convincingly enough. It just seemed like, I mean, unless I missed something fundamental from The Phantom Menace, it just seemed like Anakin got more and more sad that he just couldn't see his wife. There wasn't as much of
That was in Return of the Revenge of the Sith, wasn't it? Phantom Menace, he's more sad he can't see his mum. He had to leave his mum behind, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, and like, I think it's... I mean, his inability to save his mum is far more powerful than him not being able to save Padme.
Yeah.
But I guess to be fair, him, you know, his inability to save his mum is what is fundamentally what makes him turn.
Yeah, it's like the first, like, in a domino effect, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah. But to be fair, I guess I'm contradicting myself. I think that, you know, which is explored a bit more in Attack of the Clones, is done quite well. Like, you do genuinely feel for Anakin's tragedy.
Yeah, I do. So, like, The big things about Phantom Menace, obviously, is Jar Jar. He's like, you can't think of a Phantom Menace without thinking about Jar Jar Binks. Like, the way Ahmed Best, though, who his story of how he got in the role was incredible. Like, he was in performing in Stomp, the musical, and one of the casting directors saw him, just happened to go to that performance, and saw him, and then that's got him to audition, through that got him to audition, and that's how he got the part. Yeah.
Did you hear that story about the fact that Disney were holding open auditions, open casting for Rey and
is it Finn?
Finn, did you hear that story?
I think so, yeah.
Do you think that was true or not?
I know, I think they did see a lot of unknowns. Gotti Data Ridley was an unknown.
Yeah, but surely it couldn't have been an open casting.
I know they do have open casting for lots of roles, you know. If they like Star Wars, they like to bring in unknowns. Like, it's been a big tradition of the series to like bring in unknowns.
Sure. But then like both Rey and Finn, like the actors, John Boyega and
Daisy Ridley.
Yeah. Like they had experience before.
They did have experience, but Daisy Ridley made in student films and like a cut role in between those two. Obviously John Boyega had he had Attack the Block.
But like, what a great PR stunt. Yeah. Like, literally, re-engage all your target audience by saying, like, you know, you could be in the film.
Yeah.
Like, literally, knew their audience. You know, not Star Wars.
Obviously, Harry Potter did that as well, didn't it, for the majority of the young cast, didn't they? So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, surely that's how you launch a blockbuster.
Yeah.
You just, everyone who could be an actor, like, let's bring, like, you know, let's get you all in, like, give you some hope that you can be in the franchise.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, it's great. I think the fact they start on, they continuously bring in new talent and unknowns for like majority of the films, or they give aspiring actors like a chance to lead. You know, like obviously like Felicity Jones in Rogue One. Sure, she was a respected actress, but I think this is one of her first like big lead roles.
Yeah, I get that. I respect that. That's impressive.
And yeah. So, do you think with Phantom Menace, because it's 20 years old, like, obviously, I'm definitely going to revisit it in the run up to episode 9, but do you think it holds up still? Has your opinion on it changed massively since when you first saw it? Or
my opinion has changed because I think a lot more about stories.
Yeah.
And about the art of making a good story. That sounds so pretentious. But, I'm more involved in like the technical aspects of a film narrative.
No, effects are great. Don't get me wrong; all these special effects still hold up. I think they're fantastic, and especially like a lot of the work Ahmed Best did with Jar Jar was like a precursor to Gollum in a way, and a lot more of mocap. But
yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm sure Andy Serkis and Peter Jackson drew more on like the original 1978 into version of Gollum, but I see your point though. I don't appreciate it as like this a sci-fi great as in the same sense that I was like wowed by it as a child, but I think it's I think there are specific elements I appreciate more. I appreciate, I've come to appreciate people like, Qui-Gon Jinn for who they were and their influences, Jedi Masters. George Lucas's efforts to explore the lore a bit more. I appreciate that he went out of his way to, show some more Star Wars in a bit more detail, but didn't turn it into like National Geographic or like a David Attenborough series for the Star Wars monsters, which would also be great.
Yeah.
So I think he did well in a lot of that respect. So I think he tried to control it well, but it just ultimately fell through to lazy writing, dialogue.
Because I do appreciate a lot of the obviously, I know we do need drama to keep and like story to make sure it's not just non-stop action. But when I was younger, I remember definitely thinking, like, just have another lightsaber fight. Come on, I want to see some blasters. But now when I'm older, I kind of appreciate the politics of it a bit more, because I'm a bit more, as I got more interested in politics, as I think we all did when we get older, I think that was interesting. I think it kind of intrigued me a bit more. But obviously, that's made me really appreciate Palpatine a lot more, because I think his arc in the prequels is like the best thing in the prequels. Like, I just love Ian McDiarmid as an actor and as Palpatine. I think he absolutely smashed it.
He did. He did a great job. And I love how you don't really see Palpatine in episode 1.
He's just like a lowly senator, and you can tell he's kind of weaseling his way up already.
Yeah, like you can
he's pulling you can see him pulling the strings already.
Exactly, yeah. And it's I think that I mean,
just winking at the audience.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't surround him with as much mystery, because otherwise everyone would have been like, okay, so that's who Emperor Palpatine is.
Yeah.
It's, you know, George Lucas tried to create this whole atmosphere around, ooh, you know, it's, you're suspicious, suspicious old man. No, I think it's, I think, without sounding like those guys, it's, I don't think it lived up to its potential.
No, I definitely think...
I think George Lucas still got lazy because he knew exactly who his fans were. And he, you know, he didn't put as much effort into the story.
No, yeah, I think... Because I think he needed, like, another writer or some, like, one to, like, say no. Because obviously with, obviously episode 4 was just him, really. But episode 5 and 6, they had other directors. And I think that kind of aided it a bit more.
Sure.
And I do think the Phantom Menace would have benefited a lot more from like a script editor or just someone to sit down with him and be like, come on, George, we don't need this dialogue. This can be cut out. We don't need this. Like it's interesting to show, like, it does build. Obviously, a lot of these things are expanded on, like, which makes you, if you read the expanded universe, you kind of appreciate things more. But...
Yeah.
And it's amazing to see all these actors who had very minor roles, like Keira Knightley. Dominic West is like a guard in it. Richard Armitage is one of the pilots. You know, it's all these people who became big just had like very like walk-on roles in there.
And that's the thing, like these roles were like, they didn't get big because they were in Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a great thing to have on your CV.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's,
like, I mean, Rose Burns in the beginning of episode 2, so
is she?
Yeah, she's the pilot who dies.
Oh, like, she is. Yeah. Yeah. Shit.
And Seth Rogen's like,
he just appears in a puff of marijuana. That's true. But like, it's you know, would you, like, you could have that in your gravestone, like, was in Star Wars.
No, because
whatever.
There's this really good documentary called Elstree 1976. It's about the making of it, and it's about the guy who plays Greedo's interviewed, and he says in like the interview, like, I've acted on like National Theatre, I've done Shakespeare, I've acted against all these acting greats, but on my tombstone it's going to say, "Here lies Greedo," and I couldn't care less because that is brilliant. Something along those lines. It's like, yes, you play the most loved characters. Yeah.
But I feel like Hayden Christensen couldn't do that because he, like, you know, sure, he's known for Star Wars, and that's pretty much it, apart from a couple of other, like, you know, Loki sci-fi drama stuff. But he, you know, he was very unpopular as Anakin.
Yeah.
And a lot of people didn't like him.
He's only just returned to the convention circuit, like, now to start meeting the fans again. I think this kind of, I think people started to appreciate it a bit more now.
Yeah, but like, fans are stupid that sometimes. Like that's... It's that level of obsession where you're like, you know, someone. I mean, I also think he wasn't the best guy for the role. Or, I mean, but that's also because
the dialogue.
Yeah, just because Anakin was very wooden for the most part. Like, that's the big problem people have with Anakin Skywalker and with, you know, young Skywalker and all the other characters in the Phantom Menace, is that they're so wooden.
Like lot of the dialogue is like just not great. You know, it's like, when Anakin's like, yippee, it's just like, that's going to be Darth Vader one day. That kid's is gonna choke someone with the force.
But I think at that stage you're forgetting is he's going to become Darth Vader.
Yeah, I know.
And he's like how old is he, like 10?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, to Padme, you an angel. It's like, kind of cringing.
What? An angel?
And in episode 2...
I'm going to say that to my wife.
And like in episode 2, when he's like, you're more beautiful, I remember, you can imagine Padme furiously pressing a panic button under the table when they're having that dinner scene.
just like Tatooine gets invaded by Naboo.
And he's like, she's cutting a pear. I'm like, oh God, that's one of my favourite.
You like pear?
And he like cuts a pear with like the force or something. It's like, yeah. Oh, it's so cringy.
And he like waves his finger and swish and flick. I do love how you have these little great little cameos though of characters.
Warwick Davis, he's in Star Wars as well. He's in most of them.
Like
a
Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah.
Like when he appears at the beginning of the Portra race to eat that lizard and go, what?
Spits out. Yeah, you know, he's credited as himself in the film, in the trailers. In the credits, Jabba he's as himself. Yeah.
It's what language you learn at school, at ease. Tatooine, I did like how they spend a lot of time on Tatooine.
Yeah.
Tatooine is... I mean, obviously, like, I think it's more than the original, the Darth Anakin slash Darth Vader is from Tatooine. But, like, Tatooine is where all the fascinating things are.
It's where all the I love how, like...
It's where the crime is.
Yeah, I like how you get to see it before the Imperial rule, where it's a lot more lawless in a way, you know? You get to see all these, like, interesting characters, like Sebulba in the street. You see all these, like, creatures walking past.
And they're all gangsters. Yeah, and con men.
Yeah.
Or con artists, even.
Yeah. And it's really good. I just... Yeah. I love Mos Eisley. There was meant to be a film centred around Mos Eisley in development, but it got cancelled because Solo flopped, which I really wanted to see.
The Mos Eisley one.
Yeah.
That would have been... I mean, how would they have made that without been like a...
I think it would have been a western. Yeah.
A good crime thriller, sure.
Like, that would be great to see, like, a crime thriller, like, set from the canteen.
Yeah. So, yeah. Of, like, Robert De Niro, because... like, executive produced by Martin Scorsese.
Do you know the bartender, in episode 4, when he says, we don't serve droids here, there's a whole short story about why he doesn't serve droids. Like, it turns out like his family were attacked by the Trade Federation, and he was saved by a Jedi, which is why he lets kind of Obi-Wan get away with it, doesn't dob him into the Imperials, because he's got this massive respect for Jedi and hate for droids.
That's interesting.
And it's all these little things, which there's a whole story about, you know, Boba Fett, like, Darth Vader says no disintegration. There's actually a story where he sets some rebels on fire or something, and it annoys Vader on this mission, so that's why he says him... It's like these little weird things that become a story.
Yeah. But that's just what makes... I think... But that's what, like, that's why these things are huge franchises, because there are so many dimensions to them and so many possibilities that it's fun to create fan theories.
Yeah.
Like, people who love Star Wars and the Lord of the Rings and all these epic stories love writing stories themselves.
Yeah.
Like, they love analysing them. They love making up whole narratives and ideas and possibilities and trying to link them together.
Yeah, you see on, like, all these internet forums, people, like, writing how they think the plot of episode, like, 7, 8 and 9 will go or whatever.
Yeah.
And people comment saying, oh, no, I don't think that's going to happen. I think this is what will happen. And people just debate and have fun. And then someone just ruins it by making it personal. But, so yeah,
yeah, it's just speaking to them in a mouth they wouldn't use with their mother.
Yeah,
I think we'll always be grateful to George Lucas for creating that fun.
I think one of the things we our age is that we hold the prequels work closer. It's because we were that age where we played with the action figures. You know, we had the standalone. We played the games. You know, I remember playing the PS1 game of Phantom Menace and the pod racing game. I remember on Battlefront when you got to
Battlefront. I spent like years of my life on Battlefront 2.
And when we got to play on the boo, we got to hunt Gungans. I was like, this is fun.
The PS2 days.
Yeah, well, Xbox original in my case. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, being a purist in here.
It was just the case of playing those games, I think, made us attach to prequels. Like, playing, like, with people online, like, fighting on Geonosis and, like, or fighting in the throne, in the boo. You know, fighting in the like in all the locations of episode 3, the various ones. I think that the fun we had with those games, I think that makes us, our generation, a bit hold the prequels a lot closer.
Yeah, I mean, because that was an age where we spent all our time on video games.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't go to the pub or have other hobbies or like projects. Or
whatever. You know, it was good. Also, that's why I think at Star Wars Celebration, when Ahmed Best, who played Jar Jar, got on stage for the 20th anniversary panel, he got standing ovation. And I think that was so good to see that these people who loved Jar Jar as a kid still held him in their hearts to this day.
And that's the thing, but there are plenty of older people older than us that hate him.
Yeah.
That just find him loathsome.
Like, the dialogue was poor, I think, for Jar Jar, but I don't think it's the actor's fault at all.
I get, like, the fact that he's annoying, but they, you know, the actor tried to commit suicide. Yeah,
he did, yeah, which is, like tragic, yeah.
Cyber harassment is...
This was, like, before, like, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, isn't it? This is, like, late 90s, early 2000s, you know?
Yeah. And that's... But this is... Like, to make someone feel that level of shame for a character that they didn't write, they didn't direct, they didn't have any, like, creative influence.
Yeah, if you were, like, in theatre, like, a theatre actor with, like, one of the cast stomp, then you got off to be a lead in Star Wars, of course you would jump at the chance to do it.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's... But he's married now and he has 2 kids and he's
involved in other projects, you know, he's award-winning voice actor, won an Emmy Award.
He's living a great life.
And he still returns to play Jar Jar in, like, the voice roles in, like, the Clone Wars and stuff, still shows he still has, like, enjoys the character in a way.
He's living a great life. If you have any strong opinions on The Phantom Menace, then please don't message us, because I'm sure they'll be very intense.
Before we do go, actually, there's one thing I wanted to ask you. Out of 10, what would you give The Phantom Menace? What would you give it out of 10?
As a Star Wars film or as a film?
Just, what would you give it? Like, when I was younger, I said it was a 4 out of 5. I think now I'd give it a 7 out of 10. I think it would be a 6, but the extra 1's for Palpatine. I'm not even joking, that extra 1 is for Ian McDermott as Palpatine. And I do love Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan as well. I think he's great.
Yeah, that's true. I'm going to give it a... I'm going to give it a 4, I think. Again, there are certain scenes that stand out. I appreciate what George Lucas was trying to do, but it just really... It didn't reach its potential.
Yeah.
And thinking back on it now, 20 years later, I don't think it does the wonders for the Star Wars franchise that it intended to.
No, because it was the first Star Wars film in 16 years after, like, Return of the Jedi. There's all this hype.
Yeah. And it's not crazy. It's not a 1 or a 0 or a minus.
No,
number.
You know, for this film, you've got to remember, people used to go into the cinema just to watch the trailer, then leave. You know, that's like how much excitement there was for this film. This is the days of dial-up internet where it would take 12 hours to download the trailer.
Yeah.
You know, so people were obviously so excited for this film, and I think they couldn't accept the fact it was just good, you know, or just average. It had to be amazing, considering the quality of the original 3.
Yeah, to an extent. Please share your opinions on The Phantom Menace with us via Facebook or Twitter. We are at Tom Hanks Defense.
And don't blockade our flat.
Please. We'd love to hear your thoughts and any other ratings or
anything in general. Doesn't have to be Phantom Menace. Tell us something. Just talk to us. We're very lonely.
We're not really going out now. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next time with more madness on Twitter.
Yeah, have fun.
Bye-bye. Enjoy yourselves.
Thank you for listening to Tom Hanks Defense Force. Find us and join the conversation on Twitter and Facebook.